offering my most loving pranams at Bhagwan's lotus feet. Dear listeners, I welcome you to this week's episode of the Gita series, A Triumph Pilgrimage. This is Prem, your friend from Team Radio Sai, and I'm happy to join you all today with yet another episode of our study of the Bhagavad Gita. We are still in the second chapter, and as I've mentioned many times before, the second chapter is a beautiful summary of the entire Bhagavad Gita, and that's why I think it does take a lot of time to go through all of these verses. And the effort through this program is to place many of these concepts which are spoken of in the Bhagavad Gita in the modern context in a way it is applicable to each one of us. And even in today's episode, we will see that there are some things which Krishna speaks of which have to be applied to our lives, and for us it is far more easier because most of it Swami has done it for us, and it's only a question of reading it and putting it all together. And I think that's what we are doing it together as part of this Gita series, A Triune Pilgrimage, where each one of us are co-pilgrims. It's not that I am guiding you all or I am guide on the pilgrim. I too am a co-pilgrim, and I'm as always ever grateful to Swami for this opportunity and to all of you listeners for joining me week after week, and of course for the wonderful feedback that I keep getting every now and then. You can continue to write that, and if you have anything to add to whatever I'm saying, or if you have any clarifications on what I'm saying, because yes, I do tend to speak a little fast, and probably I might not be giving enough emphasis on some of the important concepts that I'm speaking of. Some of it, in my mind, I feel that it is going to come later, so let me not spend too much time on it. But if you want me to explain anything a little more further, I'm always open to that. You can always write to me. You can write to listener at Radio Sai, or you can write directly to me at prem@radiosai.org. I'll try to take the time out and reply to your mails. So we'll begin with today's episode, and as always, we'll start with a short introduction of what we covered the last week around. We covered three verses, and I think that somewhat is becoming the standard. Two or three verses is what we're able to cover every week. And we'll see if this is the pace or we can pick up a little more as we go. We covered verses number 41, 42 and 43 of the second chapter. Before this part, Arjuna was promised that he will be taught an approach to doing action, right? And that is what is the crux of what Arjuna is being told by Krishna here, that the standard way of doing action or standard way of going about performing karma is binding. It has this inbuilt mechanism of always having a consequence, and it kind of binds each one of us, be it good karma or bad karma. Good karma does have its advantages, but nevertheless, it binds as much as bad karma does. So Krishna promises Arjuna that I'm going to teach you a technique or a mechanism or an approach by which you can perform actions in a certain manner that it does not bind you. And of course later he is going to use the phraseology of I'm going to teach you how to do a karma within karma. That is what is the essence of the karma yoga. So he tells him that I'm going to teach you this approach, and he says in this particular approach there will be one-pointedness in the mind. There will be one-pointed resoluteness in the mind. Whereas if one were to perform karma in the regular way, going after pleasures and avoiding pain, as I explained last week, the mind will have to concentrate on so many little things, and that will lead to one losing one's one-pointed resolution. We will, of course, speak a little more about it in detail in today's episode too, because it is going to come up in the verses which we'll be taking up today. But to give you a brief of what we discussed the last week, specifically about this particular concept, when we seek only pleasures, we don't know where we will find them, right? That is the problem that most of us face. With a career, we don't know whether we have to focus on this career or should we take up that stream. If you want to buy a house, we are not sure whether we have to buy a house within the city or should we go to the suburbs. Where will we encounter lesser problem? Where will we encounter a more comfortable life? So in everything, every aspect of life, the choices that present in front of us present a confusion as to where we will find the pleasure that we are seeking, and taking which path will help us avoid encountering pains in this journey of life, right? So all of these choices lead to this kind of confusion. So life itself in that sense becomes a gamble. But when we speak about karma yoga, the complete control is in one's own hands. And that is the beauty of this approach to doing action. Because doing perfectly what has to be done at that moment, what is defined as dharma or duty, is all that is going to matter, right? All of one's pleasure is going to come from perfectly doing one's duty. We are, of course, jumping the gun here. We will be going into all of this in detail. When Krishna starts speaking about karma yoga, I think that will be the verses that we'll take up next week. We will go into the details of the nitty-gritties of karma yoga, if I could put it that way. But the essence is this, the control comes back into how I perform my actions, and the moment the control is in my hand, the ability of somebody else taking it away from me is much lesser, right? And that is what Krishna is saying here. In the verses 42 and 43, Krishna introduces the idea of the Vedas being misinterpreted by the people who are obsessed with these mundane pleasures. Right, they will end up using the Vedas for the ends of satisfying the cravings for pleasures that they have. And not only will they use the Vedas and interpret the Vedas in that manner, they will also go around saying that this is the very purpose of the Vedas and this is the only ends that the Vedas speak about. Right, and Krishna calls them all, gives a very beautiful term to refer to these people. He says, avipaschitaha, meaning that they are unwise, but the word avipaschitaha means those who do not see the entire picture, right? It is not that they do not see, they do see, but they don't see in entirety. And those who do not see the entire picture are unwise in nature, right? So he calls them avipaschitaha, those who do not see the complete value of the Vedas. And why do they not see the complete value? Because they have blinders of going after pleasures and avoiding pain. So such people who are already after pleasures will fall for such flowery interpretations of Vedas, is what Krishna says in those verses. Or we would not be wrong in saying that this is not only about the Vedas, this is a misinterpretation of the very purpose of life itself. Right? Just like how Krishna is talking about the Vedas, we can actually replace the concept of the Vedas with what is the very nature of life or what is the very purpose of life. In fact, we will dwell a little more into that in today's episode. Wherever Krishna speaks about the Vedas, it is not that, okay, this does not apply to us. Because what Krishna is saying is very, very relevant even to our day-to-day life. Right? So he says that those who fall for these misinterpretations of Vedas and those who believe that this is the very end of whatever Vedas can offer, he says that they become kamatmanaha, individuals who are filled with desires, swargapara, meaning that they people end up thinking that heaven alone is the ultimate and highest end that one can achieve, and janma karma phala pradam, who think all that we do is so that the karma phala or the consequences of our actions will lead to a good birth next time. The importance of these phrases or these descriptions that Krishna is giving, these people are not evil people. Those people who have desires and those people who have goals and aspirations and take to a righteous means to achieve them, they're not evil people, right? Or those who think that whatever charity that I'm doing, I should be able to achieve heaven, they're not bad people in that sense. Or the people who think that all the good that I'm doing in this birth, I'm going for bhajans, I'm going for seva, and I'm doing early morning meditation, next birth I will be born as a prince. I mean, it is not wrong or it is not sinful to think like that. But the reason why Krishna is singling out all of these people is, you could be a very good and noble person, but still you are not doing what is meant to be done with this human birth, right? That is the most important thing. Because all of this is being spoken to Arjuna. Arjuna is not an ordinary person, as we have mentioned so many times before. He's a very noble person. He's born in a very noble clan. He's a person of very, very noble ideas and perceptions, and a very, very successful individual. Now Krishna is taking him from just goodness to a state which is beyond both good and bad, right? For that, this is, all of these are limitations, even though they are otherwise not wrong. It is not wrong to have goals and ambitions and trying to achieve that. So this was what we went through last week. The verses we will be covering this week are also an extension of whatever Krishna was saying last week. But because it's an extension, I think it also gives us an opportunity to speak a little more about this aspect. Because this particular part is a synopsis of our own lives at this moment, right? Before Krishna starts talking about what it is to lead a noble life of a karma yogi, this is a perfect description of our lives at this point in time. We are not bad, as I just mentioned, but we could say probably we are not good enough, or we are not doing it the right way, so that our focus is completely on the goal. So we will progress with this particular portion of the Bhagavad Gita. We'll listen to shloka number 44. As always, it is very, very clearly and beautifully rendered by Brother Shyam, one of our alumnus of our university. We listen to the verse. I'll give you a short meaning of that verse, and then we will talk in detail about what Krishna says in this particular verse.
Bhogaishvarya prasaktanam tayapahrita chetasam vyavasayatmika buddhihi samadhau na vidhiyate.
One-pointed conviction does not become established in the minds of those who delight in enjoyment and affluence, and whose intellects are carried away by that speech. So here Krishna repeats the assertion, that those whose mind is distracted do not have one-pointedness. He uses the same term, vyavasayatmika buddhihi, resolute one-pointed discrimination. Samadhav na vidhiyate is not available to the mind of those, and to the mind of who? Bhoga Aishwarya Prasaktanam. Bhoga Aishwarya, we spoke about it, sense enjoyments and prosperity or opulence. Aishwarya, of course, has another meaning to it. We'll discuss about that too. Prasakta means to be obsessed with or to be completely preoccupied with something. So Bhoga Aishwarya Prasaktanam means those who are completely preoccupied with the pursuit of sense pleasures and wealth. As I said, Aishwarya is not only wealth and opulence, it also means a power and authority that comes, or influence that comes with wealth. And that is what Aishwarya actually means. Even though we have the tendency to speak of it as only as wealth, Aishwarya, the term, refers to power and authority. So Bhoga Aishwarya means one who is after the pleasures which come with satisfying the senses, and the desire for having control over others, the desire for authority and power. So why do they not have clear thinking, these people who are Bhoga Aishwarya Prasaktanam? Taya, by such things, of course the reference here is to what Krishna had told in the previous verse, which was Pushpitam Vacham, flowery words that people who misinterpret the Vedas speak, right? So he says, Taya Upahrita Chetasam. I'm sorry, Taya Apahrita Chetasam. So he says that Taya, the flowery words which are spoken, Apahrita Chetasam. Apahrita means to steal or to rob. Chetas means the mind. So their minds are stolen away by these fancy words about what the Vedas can offer. So he says their minds are stolen away by these flowery words or this misinterpretation of the Vedas by those people whose minds are already clouded as to what is the purpose of all of these. Though I said that Krishna is repeating himself, it is not to say that, okay, this is a repetition of what we heard last time, so we can just overlook this and we can go on. If Krishna has already said this and he is repeating it, it only means that it is important and we need to be told this repeatedly and focus a little more and try to understand, you know, why Krishna is repeating this and why this is important to us. I had mentioned this last week too. The scriptures, or particularly the Vedas, are literally like an ocean. They have immense wealth hidden in them. Some of the people who go to the ocean are happy with the fishes that swim on the surface, right? They catch them, they make a living out of it. but only few dive deep in pursuit of the precious pearls which are there for the taking by the ocean. The ocean does not resist and say that, you know, I will give you only the highest, those who want only fish don't come to me. That discrimination is supposed to be exercised by the person who is using this opportunity of going to the ocean, right? The ocean offers everything. The ocean offers that which is on the surface as well as that which is deep. The Vedas are similar to that. They contain, you could say, chants that can give you all kinds of worldly benefits. I could give you many examples for that. For instance, there is a suktam called the Bhagya Suktam, if I'm not wrong. I think even in the Veda Tutor on Thursdays, we have had a few classes on that. This Bhagya Suktam is chanted for getting, you know, wealth and good fortune. Right? That is the basic Falashruti, which they say, or, you know, if you chant this regularly, this is what the benefit you will get. So that is Bhagya Suktam. There is something called a Rishabha Suktam, which one of my classmates once spoke to me about. And he said, it is if you chant that very often, you will get the ability to subdue your enemies and conquer your enemies, right? If you have a lot of competition in the market and you're a startup or you're a business, probably Rishabha Suktam is what you'll have to chant, because that will give you the ability to conquer those who are your rivals. Similarly, there are so many procedures that are meant to bring down rains, to have a good harvest, you know, during the year. There are so many mantras and suktams which can be chanted by, in the house where the mother is in the family way. It is very good for childbirth. So, if you say that I will get all this, if I seek all of this, will I get all of this? When I'm saying that all of this is available in the Vedas, does that mean that if I seek all of this, I will get? Well, that's the whole problem with what we refer to as bhoga and aishwarya. None of this can ever be really had. You may attain them, you may lay your hands on them, but it is only for a very, very brief period. None of this can ever be had completely. They will all be taken away in the course of your life, right? That's the nature of life itself. Many times, you know, when I'm studying, or especially when we were studying complex subjects in chemistry, you know, we would break our heads and try to understand so many of these concepts. I would often think that, you know, at the end of life, we have put so much effort to understand some of these concepts and some of these subjects, advanced chemistry and advanced physics. One fine day you're going to die and you will be born as a baby which has no clue, which can't even mouth the words saying that it is hungry or it you know, it's happy or whatever it is. Just one moment, all the knowledge that you have labored to collect in this mind is going to be taken away and you'll be born as a babbling kid, right? So you could be a scholar with 3 PhD degrees or you could be an illiterate person. When you die and when you're born as somebody who needs to be taught the alphabets, right? Completely everything is going to be taken away from you. And same is the case, whatever programs we prepare for, we try to memorize all of these shlokas and padyams which Swami says, or we try to understand concepts. Everything is going to be wiped clean, like at the end of a class, the blackboard is going to be wiped by the class teacher before walking out, right? So that is the nature of everything that we gather in this world. You could become a millionaire, you could have built a huge mansion and you could have built a huge empire with employing thousands of people. One fine day when you die and you're born in another family, you've lost everything, right? In fact, there is this very, very beautiful Tamil song, which is often sung even in Swami's presence, Yennathavam Seidhane Yashoda, where the composer is looking at Mother Yashoda and saying that, you know, what good fortune have you done? What tapas have you done that you've had this opportunity to interact in this manner with the Lord of the universe, right? So in one particular line, he says, Brahmanum Indiranum Manadil Poramai Kolla Uralil Katti Vaiputti Kenjavaitai Thai. So the song is addressed to Mother Yashoda, as I said, and it says, you know, what tapas have you done? What good fortune have you gathered? And how have you gone about doing it? That you have made Lord Brahma and Indra jealous, because you have made the Lord, who is their master, right? Their master, you have tied him to a mortar and you have gagged his mouth and you have made him plead with folded hands. right? And if you read the Vedas, there are some of these suktams which say that if you do so many yajnas and so many yagas, you will attain the stature of Indra, right? So whatever could be the Aishwarya that one attains, or whatever could be the power and authority one attains, there will always be somebody higher than you. And even that Lord of all Lords, when he is born as a child, he also takes up, of course, he in his case, it is willfully, it is a part of his Leela. Even the Lord of the Lords takes up this kind of helplessness and this kind of complete dependence on the mother when born as a child, right? So what is the whole fun in trying to gather all these kind of things? I want to be a CEO, I want to be a prime minister, I want to be whatever in the organization, I want to be a coordinator, I want to be a state president. Everything is going to be taken away over a period of time. And that is the problem with the Bhoga Aishwarya we go after. So whatever pleasure, comfort, power or authority we seek, everything is of a fleeting nature. Swami says that even heaven that can be attained after one beautiful life that you have led of all good actions, even that is of a fleeting nature. Swami would give the example of a parliamentarian being elected to the parliament. He said, Swami would say that, you could even be the prime minister, but your tenure is only 5 years. After that, you have to go and get re-elected and come. So even heaven is like that, that for the good actions that you've done, for a brief period, you are given that reprieve. But after that, you will have to go back to the world and start laboring again, right? So even when we talk about Bhoga and Aishwarya, I can never be at rest and say that I have got it. Even when I get it, I am going to lose it and I will have to seek it again. That is why this is a huge distraction. But why does Krishna say that these flowery words steal your mind? They rob your mind of what it is, right? That's what he says. He says, apahrita chetasam. So why does Krishna use that idea that it is something which steals your mind away? There's a very, very beautiful and profound analogy that I'd come across sometime back. Apparently in the olden days, when they used to store huge amounts of grains after a harvest in a storeroom or in a godown, they would do this particular technique, or they would use this particular technique to keep the rats away from the grains. Well, this is an analogy I've heard from somewhere. I'm not too sure if this technique really works. So if you're going to try it out in your own houses, it's at your own risk. And don't come back to me and say that, oh, you told us this analogy and we tried it out and the rats were not dealt with. So this is just an analogy, and it's a very beautiful analogy because it's very deep and profound in many levels, and that's why I want to quote it here. So what they would do is, they had this, they would put the grains in huge sacks of water, sacks, and they would pile up these sacks in one corner of the godown or in one corner of the storeroom, right? So when these rats would come, they wanted to keep these rats away from these particular sacks of grain. So what they would do is, they would take some puffed rice, right? Puffed rice, and they would put it right in the middle of the godown or right in the middle of the storeroom. So the rats which would come, they would look at all of these puffed rice, which is so easily available. They would come, eat the puffed rice and leave, not realizing that if they were to just go a little beyond that point, if they were to just go to the corner, there was this huge reserve of grains that they could feast upon. And that is why this is a very, very beautiful analogy. The puffed rice, when you talk of the puffed rice, what it is made of is the same grains which are there in the sack is what is made into puffed rice, right? But of course it involves a certain process, but nevertheless it is essentially the same material. And the nature of puffed rice is such that with just a fistful of rice or rice grains or whatever we call that, with just a fistful of those grains, you could get a huge and enormous quantity of puffed rice. In fact, even when we were children, we used to have these hawkers who would come home to home selling puffed rice. And we would be fascinated as children looking at the huge bag that he would carry, a huge sack. Single-handedly, the man or a lady would come carrying door to door. Because, you can't imagine carrying a sack of rice of that size home to home. But puffed rice was so easy because it was, predominantly air filled into that rice. Right? So when we say that puffed rice distracts the rats from all the rice grains that it can take, what we mean is that the rice grains are there for its taking, right? In the rodent's mind, there is nothing like, oh, those rice grains belong to so-and-so that I am coming in and stealing them. No, it's not like that in the mind of these rats. It's like it is there. If no one's watching, it's going to go and take it. So there is no idea of propriety or, you know, belonging in its mind. So when we say that these puffed rice are put there, it literally steals away the opportunity of the rat of going and taking the rice grains, because it is obsessed with this easily available puffed rice, which is right in center, right? When we talk about bhoga and aishwarya, what is it? Essentially, what are these bhoga and aishwarya? Swami would say this, all happiness comes only from within. Even the pleasures that we feel when we gratify our senses, the happiness we experience does not come from outside, it comes only from within. And deep within, we have this huge reserve of bliss, which is there for the taking. But because we are constantly going after these small pleasures and small happiness that we get, which is doled out through these sense pleasures that we experience, our mind is robbed away of this opportunity of turning within and accessing this huge, unlimited and eternal reserve of bliss, which is there. Right? And that is what is referred to by Krishna as apahrita chetasam, a mind that has been robbed. And when Krishna says the flowery words rob the mind, the Vedas are capable of giving us so much more. But if we are told that you can chant this and get this benefit, you can chant that and become powerful, we are going after pleasures and securities that are trivial, first of all, and that are fleeting, because you have to keep coming back and seeking them again and again. And the whole problem is the Vedas can give so much more than just that. We are being, you know, cheated by giving peanuts. And, you know, we come to this ocean of knowledge, ocean. We only seek what is there in the surface, and we go back. And every time we come, we are only coming and seeking only what is in the surface. We never go deeper than that. Same is the case when we talk about Aishwarya too, or power. Swami says that we are essentially the masters of the universe. In reality, we are Supreme Parabrahman itself. But we crave for all kinds of worldly authority and power and lose out on what truly can be achieved, right? So when we go after these bhoga and aishwarya, our minds are robbed of a great opportunity. And then the mind loses its ability to have vyavasayatmika buddhi, which is one-pointed discrimination and intelligence. And when there is no focus, we only become more restless and crave more for bhoga and aishwarya. And this cycle continues. That is what Krishna is essentially explaining in these past few verses. I'll just repeat that again, because this is what he is saying. First of all, we are all right now in that state where we want bhoga and aishwarya. As I said, it is not about being a good person or a bad person. We are after some benefits or the other. We are after some comforts or the other. And all of us, we are looking at some kind of promotion in our own lives, some kind of, improvement in our career. So we all are after bhoga and aishwarya. And he says that as long as we are after bhoga and aishwarya, that will lead to we losing this one-pointed attention, which the buddhi is capable of. The vyavasayatmika buddhi is lost from the mind. And once that is lost, he says in the previous shloka, he had mentioned that your mind is going to be pulled in different directions. And when it gets pulled in different directions, it is going to lead to you being distracted and being restless. And when you're restless, you again seek more pleasures from the world. And it becomes like a cycle. The more the pleasures that you seek, more you lose your balance. The more you lose your balance, the more you want to seek and crave for. But how do you break this whole thing? When the mind is fixed on the ultimate, the same mantras will be chanted seeking something higher, right? The same Vedas will give you the ways by which you can break the cycle and go beyond. When you say that, for instance, when you say that wealth, if you chant this, you're going to get wealth, it will not be material wealth that you will seek when you chant those verses or mantras. You will be seeking the wealth of knowledge in that sense, right? a very simple example that I can think of when you're talking about the Vedas is the Trayambaka mantra. You all must have heard it. It is part of the Rudram chanting, and towards the end it comes. It is also referred to as the Mahamrityunjaya mantra, which goes Om Trayambakam Yajamahe Sugandhim Pushtivardhanam Urvarukamiva Bandhanan Mrityor Mukshiyam Amritat. Right? This is called the Mrityunjaya mantra, and chanting this is supposed to grant good health, right? Mrityunjaya itself means gives you the ability to win over death, right? So if you chant this mantra regularly, you're supposed to get good health. If someone is not well, someone is ailing, either that person chants or you sit next to him and chants, sit next to him and chant, it is supposed to help that person recover from ill health. But if we really look at what the meaning of this mantra is, what this mantra really stands for, it says, Urva Rukamiva Bandhanat. Like the cucumber breaks free from the bondage. The reference here is to the nature of ripe cucumber. Ripe cucumber, it is said that the gardener does not have to pluck it from the creeper. It falls off the creeper the moment it becomes ripe. So he says, Urva Rukamiva Bandhanan. Just like how the cucumber breaks free from bondage, Mrityor Mukshiyam Amritat. May I be liberated from death through immortality. So the essence of the mantra is so profound, but its benefits are worldly wealth too. In fact, something similar to this is referred to by Swami in one of his Samukos discourses. And when Swami was talking about the Pranava mantra, what we call the Omkar, right? So Swami was saying that just without knowing anything about the Pranava mantra, the nature of the Pranava mantra, if you were to sit and constantly chant, you know, it is followed even in the mandir here. We have the 21 Omkars chanted early in the morning. We have 3 Omkars chanted before the Veda, before the bhajan, right? So without any knowledge of what the Pranava stands for, Swami says that if you chant it regularly, there are so many worldly benefits to be achieved. It will improve your health. It will lead to, you know, better memory. It will improve the sharpness of your intelligence. And all of these worldly benefits can be seen coming to you merely by chanting the Pranava mantra. But then Swami goes on to say, but if you know what the Pranava mantra stands for, if you know what it represents and then chant it, Swami says that you will receive benefits that are beyond this world, that you will reach heaven. But then he goes on to say, when you chant the mantra, contemplate on its meaning and also indulge in sadhana, which in this case we can say is the Karma Yoga. Then one will get the ultimate benefit. So the Omkara itself is a very good example, which, you know, Omkara itself represents the whole Vedas, what the Vedas can give. So what we seek is what we will get. Now, coming to the point of, you know, the whole discussion is about the Vedas and how is it relevant to us, you know, somebody might think that, oh, anyway, I'm not so much into studying of the Vedas. I'm not reading the Upanishads and chanting Vedas in my Sai Center or home. So probably this is not relevant to me. And I'm not a ritualist. I'm not going to go and look for all these yajnas and yagas and mantras. The Vedas are only representative, and there are multiple reasons why Krishna is speaking about the Vedas and the misinterpretation of the Vedas, right? One of the roles of the avatar is to correct how some of these great scriptures which have been handed down from generation to generation are interpreted, right? In fact, there's a very, very beautiful padyam that Swami would often say. He says, Yuga dharma paddatul vikritamayunda nayamarga munatrippi nadupu koraku. Swami would say that this is one of the purposes an avatar comes for. Yuga dharma paddatul vikritamayunda. The practices of moral codes of that particular age, when they are in a state of distortion, vikrutamayunda, nayamarga munatrippi nadupu koraku, to correct people's interpretation of these verses, to correct people's interpretation of these concepts, nayamarga munatrippi nadupu koraku, to put them on the right track and to lead them to the goal, is one of the roles of the avatar. So in that sense, to correct the way the people were looking at the Vedas, they were all tending towards using the Vedas for the benefits that one can get by doing yajnas and yagas, right? So to correct that idea that the Vedas were only meant for that, the Karmakanda of the Vedas were all important, to correct that vision was one of the most important tasks of the avatar of that particular age, right? But what Krishna is saying here about the Vedas can definitely be applied even to our lives if we were to think that if you look at the whole thing from the viewpoint of human birth itself. I have this entire lifetime with me. What am I supposed to do with this lifetime? And if you go around, all kinds of people will tell you all kinds of things. They will give you rosy pictures of how you can, you know, lead your life filled with pleasures, how you can earn power and how you can lead a comfortable life and fame and all of that, right? Any number of people will come and tell you how the life has to be utilized. Yes, all of these can be achieved with the human birth. But if we use this birth in the right manner, we can get Paramanandam itself, as we saw last week. Ihamuna sukimpa hema taraka vidya, paramuna sukimpa brahma vidya. If we were to use this lifetime to focus on something much greater, like what Krishna is saying, you can get something which is much, much more than that. And there's a very, very beautiful description which Krishna gives in one of the verses which probably will be coming in the end of today's show, where he says what happens when you go after the ultimate pleasure rather than the lesser pleasures. But for now, going back to the verse that we are going through, so either we try to start by disciplining the mind and having a ceiling on desires, right? That's what he is saying. When we go after bhoga and aishwarya and prasaktanam, right? That's a very important word Krishna uses there. Prasaktanam means single-pointedly going after it. That is the problem. Krishna is talking about the worst-case scenario, that when somebody is completely obsessed only in bhoga and aishwarya, all of this will happen. So either you start by disciplining your mind, what Swami has given us in the form of the Ceiling on Desires program. You start with that. And when you start controlling your obsession for bhoga and aishwarya, Krishna says that your mind will slowly start seeing more clearly, right? It'll start seeing the larger picture. It'll start seeing in a focused manner. And that is what he's been saying, that it'll give you that one-pointed resolution over a period of time. Or you can start by focusing on the purpose of life one-pointedly. Either you start by disciplining your mind and saying that, have a ceiling on desires, or do you start reiterating and concentrating and focusing on what is the purpose of life? But of course, the best and the most optimum method would be to do a little bit of both, right? Do a little bit of ceiling on desires too. Also keep reminding ourselves of what is the purpose of life, or reminding ourselves that we cannot be caught up in these little gains which life is there to offer. Right? And that is precisely the method which Swami has taught all of us. And as we progress in the Gita, Krishna will teach us where the idea of doing karma in a certain way fits into this equation, where bhakti and dhyana fit into this equation. All of this is going to come. But the essence is this, that to an extent control, right now we are in a state where all our actions are driven by bhoga and aishwarya, or as we saw last week, raga and dvesha, what I like and what I don't like. I want pleasure, I don't want pain. Every action is being driven only by this. To an extent, put a control on that and say that this is what I need to do. I am not going to worry about what are going to be the results. Bringing in that idea a little, and also keep reminding yourself of what is the very purpose of this human existence? Why has this birth been given to me? Both of these together will make that one-pointed focus become stronger and stronger, and your resolve to march towards the goal will become even more resolute, right? That is the essence of this particular verse. We'll go to the next verse, which is verse number 45. We'll listen to it, and then I'll give you a short meaning, and then we'll discuss about it.
Traigunya vishaya veda nistraigunyo bhavarjuna nirdvandvo nitya satvastho niryoga kshema atmavan.
The Vedas deal with the three attributes: you be above the three attributes. O Arjuna, free yourself from the pairs of opposites and ever remain in the quality of sattva. Freed from the thought of acquisition and preservation and be master of yourself. So again, what Krishna tells here can be applied to life itself, as I just told you before I played that particular verse. He says here that the Vedas contain in them all the three qualities. What are they? Sattva, Rajas and Tamas. And I'm certainly not going to go into what each one of them stand for and mean. One, because I'm sure that most of you listeners will have a basic idea of what these three gunas are. And secondly, it is also because we will be going through these concepts of the gunas in detail shortly in the Bhagavad Gita itself. So Krishna says, Trigunya Vishaya Veda. The Vedas deal with the three gunas, the Triguna. Life itself, if you look at it, as Swami has said many, many times in his discourses, is a mix of all of these gunas. So when Krishna says that Trigunya Vishaya Veda, we could even apply that to our lives. But now continuing with what Krishna is saying here, he says, Trigunya Vishaya Veda Nistrigunyo Bhava Arjuna. He's telling that the world or the Vedas are filled with the three gunas, but O Arjuna, you should be beyond the gunas. Nistrigunyo Bhava Arjuna. Meaning the Vedas offer everything that which are represented by the three gunas. But you must seek that which takes you beyond all the gunas or makes you attributeless. The way Adi Shankara interprets this particular phrase, which where you say Trigunyo Vishayo Veda. In fact, he does it a little differently. He says, since this particular shloka is following the shloka on people who are obsessed with pleasure and power, Bhoga Aishwarya Prasaktanam, Shankara says that the Veda is Trigunya Vishaya for such people who are constantly obsessed with Bhoga and Aishwarya. Not that the Veda itself is only about the three gunas. So when the mind is filled with such craving, one looks at the Vedas as dealing only with the three gunas. But Arjuna, you must not look at it like that. You must try to go beyond the three gunas. So the question comes, what is the process? Krishna explains in the very next line. He says, Nirdvandvo bhava. Be beyond the dualities of life. What are the dualities of life? Sukadukhe labha labhau jaya jayau. So that's the point Krishna is emphasizing over and over again. Aspire to be unaffected by pain and sorrow. Aspire to be unaffected by pain and sorrow. We might say that, oh, but that is a very difficult thing. How can we not be affected by pain? Well, absolutely, we all struggle with that. But I think I would not be wrong if I say what Krishna is suggesting in this particular verse and the earlier one is just a change in programming. So what Krishna is talking about here is only a change in programming. Instead of basing purely all our pursuits on raga and dvesha, can you think from the point of view of transcending it also? And the idea is to bring in that concept in the thinking process too. When we are in trouble or sad or in problem, we all will try to get out of it. That's absolutely natural. But even as we do that, can we remind ourselves, can I not be disturbed? Can I try to become a little more detached and equanimous? Right? That is the idea that Krishna is speaking of here. And then he goes on to say, Nitya sattvastho bhava. You should transcend the three gunas. But the means for that is through practicing or establishing oneself in the sattva guna. This again is a very, very important message of the Gita and in fact essentially the method that Swami has taught us too, isn't it? We must all transcend all duality, be undisturbed by what appears to be good or bad, but the means for achieving it is through goodness and nobility. Krishna is telling, Nistrigunyo Bhava Arjuna, but how? By becoming a Nitya Sattvastaha, one who is established in the Sattva Guna, which means by following what we refer to as basic morality or Sangha Niti. we all have desires. You know, we all have this wish to grow in power and influence. But the basic nature should be, I don't want to hurt anyone in the process. So as we can see, Arjuna has a bit of that Sattvaguna actually. In fact, all of us have that Sattvaguna. One of the means of preserving that Sattvaguna itself is not to be too obsessed with the Dvandvas. So being a Nirdvandva is like a fence around the idea of being a Nitya Sattvastaha or being ever established in goodness. Then Krishna goes on to say, Niryoga Kshema Bhava. Niryoga Kshema Bhava. He is referring to these two words, which are yoga and shema. Of course, we have spoken a little about yoga and we have mentioned about the higher meaning of the word, or the ultimate meaning of the word yoga, which means to be in a merger with God. But yoga also has a very simple and mundane meaning in Sanskrit itself, and I think that is what is being referred to here. What we want, when we want something and then we attain it, it is referred to as yoga. I want to become a millionaire, I work hard and become one with that idea. I have made that million mine. That is yoga. Or when I like someone and eventually get married to that person, that is yoga. When I want to learn how to play an instrument, say a tabla or harmonium, I put effort. And when I put in some effort and learn, when I acquire that knowledge, that is yoga. So attaining or making yours what you aspire or desire for is yoga. At least in this particular verse, that is the reference which is being made. After I have attained it, I must now preserve it. I earn $1 million, but I don't want to simply spend it and see it diminish, right? Then I will end up investing a part of it. So my status of being millionaire can be preserved, and hopefully I also wish that it will grow. Similarly, you know, getting married to the person that you like is only the first step. Then you must again labor to make that marriage work. I learn music, but unless I practice, I will lose touch. So this act of preserving and making flourish, which is already yours, is what is referred to as kshema. Like I always like to make this comparison, it is always like this rock climbing. I aspire to go higher, but simultaneously I have to also ensure that I don't slip and fall. And also from the grip, move ahead. So throughout life, the karmas or the actions that we perform are defined by firstly raga and dvesha, what I like, what I dislike, and yoga and shema. That is, I must attain what I like and I must preserve what I have attained. So going back to where all of this has begun, Krishna is giving him a comparison of how karma is performed usually in the world, which is karma that binds, and how it is different from karma that liberates. Karma that is binding is performed with the dvandvas or the dualities in mind, because the desire and fear relating to the dvandvas drive you. You tend to seek only the trigunya aspects of life, or the aspects of life which are defined by the three gunas. And then all our actions performed to attain something, all our actions are performed constantly to either attain something or preserve what has been attained, yoga or kshema. In the process, Krishna says the casuality is dharma. And one gets caught up in this cycle of action and reaction, as we just saw in the previous verse. So, but if you look at this whole thing which Krishna is explaining, what Krishna is telling is, first ask yourself, what is the duty, and perform it. Also slowly try to develop equanimity or samatvam. In this shloka, Krishna calls it being nirdvandva and adds to be driven by sattvaguna, right? He says, first be a nirdvandva and then ensure that whatever you're doing is being driven by sattvaguna and it is not driven by desire or to attain and preserve, or yoga and shema. And being established in such goodness, whatever be the situation, he calls it be a nitya sattvasta. Being firmly established in goodness always, nityaha. Then Krishna sums it all by saying, Atmavan bhava. Here, Atma does not stand for the divine self. Atma also means, whatever you refer to as just the self. It is not necessarily the ultimate self. So when Krishna says, Atmavan bhava, Atmavan means be one who is in control of oneself, someone who chooses what is to be done, someone who resolves what is the goal and then overcomes the distractions. So when we listen to all of these verses, I think we should never give in to the desperation or the feeling that, oh, I don't follow all of this. What am I going to do? And, you know, Krishna is telling all of these things and my life seems to be so distant from all of these messages. The first step is to be aware that life is more than just the pleasure, the success and the glory within this particular world. And then keep reminding ourselves of that constantly. Right now, we are a product of many, many lifetimes, right? That's what Swami would often say. The many, many pursuits of many lifetimes is what defines what we are today. In one day, we will not be able to turn around and become all of this, nirdvandva, nityasatvasta, and nirdyogakshema, and atmavan. But if we keep reminding ourselves and orienting ourselves slowly, it is like this beautiful example that somebody once gave. It's like a huge ocean liner. Now, if you want to turn around, let's say you're driving a motorbike or a scooter, you can just stop, take a 180 degree turn and you can go. But you cannot do that with these ocean liners, which are huge, which are in the middle of the ocean. How they would turn it around is they would, you know, every minute they would turn it about 1 degree at a time. So over a long period of time, it just goes around and comes 180 degrees, right? Our life is also like that. As we continue to move in the direction we have been moving all these birds, very small changes, but consistent changes and a lot of patience, right? That is what is going to make us turn around completely. And that is the verse that we covered, which is like the 45th verse of the second chapter. I think we just have a little time enough to listen to the next verse. We will probably not go into the details of that, but we'll listen to it and then I'll give you a brief meaning and we'll conclude with that.
Yavanarthavudapane sarvatas samplutodake tavan sarveshu vedeshu brahmanasya vijanatah.
A brahmana with realization has that much utility in all the Vedas as a man has in a well when there is a flood all around. So going back to that question that I raised some time back, so one may ask, if I conquer all of these things and if I become a nirdvandva and nir-yoga-kshema, then what will happen to all the joy in my life? What will happen to all the pleasure that I'm right now feeling? And this is where the explanation of what are pleasures that I gave in the beginning, when we spoke about, you know, the analogy of the puffed rice and the grains and the rat comes into picture here. All these pleasures are only very, very tiny means by which the spring of bliss that is already ours is presented before us, right? That's what Swami would say. Even the concept of the panchakosha, Swami would say the innermost sheath is the Anandamaya. So whatever you do in everyday life is only doling out that Ananda from within, but we are thinking that it is coming from outside and we start chasing all of this in the world outside, right? In fact, as Krishna says here, they end up being distractions for us from turning within and seeking that immense potential for unlimited bliss. And once we hit that reservoir of bliss, why would we ever need all of these small means of reaching that bliss? And that's precisely what Krishna very beautifully through an analogy explains in the shloka. Uda means water. Udapane means a small well or a pond of water. Sampluta udake means a flood of water. So Krishna says here, yavan artha, how much use would be udapane, a pond or well of water, when sarvataha samplutok udake, which means when there is a flood of water around you, how much need or necessity you will have for a pond of water or going in search of a reserve of water. Tavan, similarly, is the utility sarveshu vedeshu of all that the Vedas can offer, brahmanasya vijanataha, for a man who knows the Brahman completely. So when Krishna says here, brahmanasya vijanataha, it is not the caste Brahmin, but one who is seeking Brahman and who has attained that complete knowledge of Brahman. Such a person, as we've been going through all this while, hits upon, as Krishna says, the reserve of Ananda which is within. And once you find that, why would you go after these bhoga and aishwarya? You will not be a bhoga aishwarya prasaktanam, as Krishna says here. You will not be obsessed with that because you know that it is already yours. The happiness that you sense, the pleasure that you feel is already yours, and you don't need an external stimuli to dole out this happiness from within you. So he says a very, very beautiful example. What is the use for a person, for a pond of water when there is a flood of water all around you? That much is the use of what the Vedas can offer. And when he says Vedas here, as we've been going through all this while, it refers to the karma kanda of the Vedas, where the Vedas say that you can do this ritual and you can attain this power and you can attain this wealth. All of these flowery words that people interpret the Vedas to be is of no use to a person who has hit upon that bliss through the knowledge of the Brahman. And this is where the prelude to what Krishna is going to talk about as the Karma Yoga ends, because as we are going to continue, as from the verse 47 are the verses which clearly define what Karma Yoga is, and I think we'll have to take up that next week. We'll do that next Thursday, 7:30 p.m. in the next episode of the Gita series, The Triumph Pilgrimage. Thank you, dear listeners, for being with you. I most humbly offer this effort at Swami's lotus feet. I'll join you all again next week with verse number 47 and the verses that follow. In a short while from now, you'll be joined by Brother Bishu and his team for the Vahini Satsang, which will be the last segment for today's Thursday Live. I'll meet you all again next week. Thank you. Jai Sairam.
are listening to Radio Sai Thursday Live. Stay tuned.